Good morning. What's going on? Huh? Sunday morning? Having a nice little coffee? Maybe getting settled in? Maybe just waking up? Cleaning the shit out of your eyes? Ready for a nice little Sunday? Maybe with your family? Maybe you'll go to brunch? Well, boom, motherfuckers! It's 5:45 a.m. when we're recording this at the QTR household, and we're hyped up. We're ready to roll. I got my man Tesla Charts on today. I said, you know what? There's a lot going on, so let's start early in the day just in case you need all 24 hours of the day before everybody goes to work on Monday to say everything you gotta say. That was the real discussion. So that's why we are coming to you very early. I hope you guys are enjoying your morning if it is morning. First and foremost, this podcast is brought to you by my patrons. Patrons are people that donate monthly recurring sums to help support the podcast. I'm going to shout them out, get that out of the way, and then we are going to be on to the podcast. First and foremost are my friends over at The Trader's Path. The Trader's Path is a brand new investor education and investor advocacy day trader service for people who trade on the daily. They trade equities, they trade options, they go long, they go short, they don't mess with garbage, low float crap. Pete from The Trader's Path is a defector from other day trading services. He checked out everything that everybody else was doing wrong and said, I'm going to start my own shit and do everything the right way. He does daily watch lists. He does daily live stream. He does investor education. If you're a day trader, check out The Trader's Path. The link is in my podcast description. This podcast also brought to you by my friends at Sanglucci Trading. They got a lot of shit going on over there. First and foremost, their bread and butter is following big money moves in the options market and using those to try and distinguish where certain equities are going to go. This is what they've been doing for years, almost a decade now that I've known these guys. They are some of the best at it. They are some of the originals to do it on Twitter, to do it with online chat rooms and steam rooms, as they call their room. So my friends over at Sanglucci Trading are always chasing the paper, reading the tape, checking out what's going on with the psychology of the market. They have a master course that is linked to in my podcast description, and they also have something called the 3LT playbook, which is the three rules Lucci uses and has used to become the baller that he is today, folks. He parties in Puerto Rico, ladies and gentlemen. So check out my friends over at Sanglucci Trading. This podcast also brought to you by my friends over at RumorHound.ai. We're going to give you a free 14-day trial if you want it to RumorHound. That link is in the podcast description. Well, what is RumorHound, Chris? Good fucking question. RumorHound is a brand new piece of AI-based software that's going to help you sort through mergers and acquisitions rumors, of which there are many. They're online, they're in chat rooms, they're on the mainstream media, they're in the news, and try to help you distinguish which M&A rumors could have some basis in fact to them, which ones are likely to consummate, and which ones are not likely to consummate. So check out my friends over at RumorHound. They have this innovative AI-based tool that makes it easy for you. It looks at a bunch of different variables and then spits back to you a nice, easy recommendation that you can look at in 2 seconds, especially if you're a day trader, and understand whether an M&A rumor is worth following or maybe worth ignoring. Check out RumorHound, 14-day trial in the podcast description. This podcast also brought to you by my friends at Focused Compounding. Focused Compounding is a group of traders. All they do is follow trades and niche investments in the market that you're not going to get from analysts and you're not going to get from Wall Street. They look deep into the crevices of the market to deliver opportunities that you may not have known about. So they focus only on these types of opportunities that nobody has come across just yet. You can check out Focus Compounding on YouTube and check out their podcast. The link is in my podcast description. But their Twitter account, at Focused Compound, is 100% free. And often they drop their ideas right on their Twitter account. So check out my friends over at Focused Compounding. This podcast and all my podcasts also brought to you by my friends at Hella Bacon, who shoot machine guns from helicopters in Texas, Jameson Trinker, my friends at Corvus Gold, my friends at Investors Underground, Piggly Wiggly, whatever your new name is now. I forgot what you changed it to. I got to check it here. The artist formerly known as Piggly Wiggly. I'll find it next time. Investors Underground, my buddy Nate Michaud over there, Chris Boas, Ken R., Chris Bede, Nicholas Parks, Matthew Zimmer, shipping analyst Jay Mintzmyer, and my homeboy Russ Valenti. Thank you guys so much. And of course, some of my newest patrons. Before we get started, these are people that have donated of recent. Just want to shout you out, and then we're going to get going. First and foremost, what's going on? David Hansen, Tony V, I don't think you want me to say your name, if I remember correctly. The invisible hand job is in the house. Charles H. Parkhurst. Yuri Verliano Brito de Camaragos. What's going on, my homeboy, I think, or girl? Whatever. It's my gender-neutral friend. John W., Christian A., Peter McCausey, and Mark Wicker. How you guys doing? All new patrons. And some people that have been with me for a while, like James Cotton. And let's see, Dr. Robert Weisberg. I still see you. I get your emails once in a while, brother. Wallaby390 and Sheer Luck are still both in the house. My homeboy at Pivotal Capital. What's going on? VJ Sampath, Mitchell Penrod, Will Dog, my man Sean Dellinger and Jackson F. Fraser McKenzie still here. Robert Cope over at Cope Systems and my homeboys over at End the Fed. What's going on? Mark Jeftovich. I still see you. All right. What do you say we get started on a Sunday morning? Seeing as how I'm talking like I got a mouthful of fucking marbles because I'm not awake yet. And I don't want to keep our guest waiting any longer. 2-drink minimum. This is not financial advice. Let's get going. So for those that are new to the podcast or you haven't listened before, we are skeptics of the company Tesla on this podcast. We're not the biggest fan. We like the mission. You know, hey, all right, everybody's cool with the idea of green energy and eliminating all the bad fossil fuels and things of that nature, the evil oil companies, I guess. But we have a long-standing beef here with Mr. Elon Musk and the way he's been running his public company. One of the characters that I have had here on the show is known only by his Twitter handle. He comes on to discuss Tesla. He's one of several colorful characters I have. Actually, one of the more knowledgeable ones. And he goes only by his Twitter handle, which is at Tesla Charts. And for the most part, if you go to at Tesla Charts, what you're going to get is a bunch of charts about Tesla. Very self-explanatory, of course. And just general skepticism about the company and you know, a guy who, you know, he's told his story on this podcast before about why he's skeptical of the company. He's an expert in the area of solar. So we've had him on to talk about the company's solar energy boondoggle with Solar City and the merger of Solar City and Tesla, which we'll touch on today, and just many other things. And I feel like it's so early and I'm just droning on with talking and I have nothing productive to say. So I hope that's an adequate enough introduction. Mr. Tesla Charts, good Sunday morning to you, Mr. Charts. How are you?
Good morning, Chris. How am I? I'm feel like Mike Tyson looking for his mouthpiece in Tokyo after Buster Douglas.
Well, Tesla...
Put him on the canvas.
Tesla Shorts. So let's start off immediately with the good news for Tesla Shorts, which is that most of us got our dicks punched in over the last week as Tesla reported a surprise profit during their earnings report last week, causing the stock to rally more than about 30%, I think, actually, from Wednesday to Friday's close last week. So, yeah, the egos are probably a little bruised, if there are some egos, and certainly some accounts got bruised, I'm sure, over the last week. What's your take on the earnings report, brother?
Yeah, well, before we jump into the earnings report, I'd point out that Thursday was... I saw on Twitter that from a sort of a statistics perspective, Thursday was a five sigma move, and Friday, follow-on squeeze on Friday, was a 2.5 sigma move. And I would say, when you asked me how I was doing, I was going to joke and say, not doing as well as I was $140 ago. Remember when the stock was down to 170 and change. It's almost doubled since then, which is really amazing. The story just continues to go on and on. We'll talk a lot about the earnings report, a bunch of other stuff. But before we dive into that, I just say, you know, it was a tough week financially for me. It was a tough week financially for I'm sure a lot of members of Tesla Q. I've never been in a position where I would benefit from the stock going up. Some of the guys in Tesla Q managed to sort of pivot the trade from Thursday to Friday to limit the damage. I'm sort of happy for them. I'm sad for anybody that lost money on the trade. I certainly lost money this week. That's what happens when you invest. So it is what it is. You know, you got to tip your hat to him. By his measure, the stock price is the only scorecard that matters. And by the only scorecard that matters to him, he won the week.
He definitely won the week. Definitely.
Yeah. And you have to tip your hat. I would still say that Tesla stock is substantially trailing the indices for the year. And so if you had reasonably good position size and it was part of your overall short portfolio, Tesla is still a pretty good short. But as always, and as you say in your introduction, you know, nothing I say is investment advice. Nothing I've ever tweeted should be construed as investment advice. I've tried very carefully to never give investment advice. But it is what it is, and it sucks. I mean, there's no other way to say it. One of the reasons why I wanted to come on is because, you know, the easy thing to do would just be hide, you know, delete your account and go away. I'm not that guy. Many of the folks in Tesla Q aren't that type of person. So one of the reasons I wanted to come on is just to say that, you know, we're still here. Tesla Q still believes what it believes about the stock and the person, primarily the person who runs it. And I don't think any of that's going to go away. I think he thinks if he could screw the shorts, they'll somehow disappear and his problems will go away. And I just don't see that.
Well, I think what would drive the shorts away would be sustained profitability, not one-off quarters from one-time items or, you know, holding back payables or juking the numbers or whatever you have to do to, you know, for one quarter post a surprise like he did this past quarter. I do think it's really important that, you know, people that are skeptical show up on, you know, at times like this, because I think it's the right thing to do. And look, like you said, first off, nothing that we say on the podcast is investment advice. We, you know, we talk about our personal accounts. You talk about yours. I don't sometimes talk about mine, but my other guests sometimes talk about theirs. We're not out there telling people what to do. We're just trying to give our opinion and explain our reasoning and our logic for the way that we feel. But I think times like these, it's even more important to come back and kind of own it. And certainly, like you said, you know, a lot of people got their ass kicked this last week. People that we're friendly with that are in the community of skeptics. So the day was certainly won by Musk, regardless of how he did it. He's definitely, one famous short seller texted me after earnings came out. He just texted me, "He is a fighter." That is it. And I said, No, there's no doubt the man is a fighter. There's no doubt.
No doubt about it. And just to build on that, you know, much to my surprise and shock, my account has become prominent, way more prominent than I ever anticipated when I started it. And for some reason, I think I particularly get under Elon's skin, so I'm a target of a lot of the sort of counter social media strategy. There's at least 20 fake Tesla Charts accounts that have my avatar on it and a very similar name. You know, they just make minor changes. They put in an underscore. The wave of those bots after earnings sort of going out and making statements attributable to me that aren't true to try to sort of affect the zeitgeist. And then that bot army basically is, you know, the fake Tesla Charts accounts and then a bunch of other bots. There's thousands and thousands of bots on Twitter that are pro Tesla. I don't know for sure where they come from, but it seems like an odd phenomenon to just spontaneously occur. You know, those bots are out there trying to divide Tesla Q and spike the football. A lot of them are sort of blaming me for Tesla Q losing money. It's actually very hurtful, as you can imagine, because I'm an empathetic guy. I got to know many of the members of Tesla Q. I think the point of those bots is to sort of make you want to quit, but I'm not a quitter, and I plan to be here. I'll just say that if you search, you know how to search on Twitter, if you search trade from Tesla Charts, the word that almost always follows it is carefully. And if you search trading from Tesla Charts, the word that comes before it is not, and the word that comes after it is advice. But it is what it is. As careful as you can be, people are still going to, you know, and that comes with the territory of a high profile account, I guess. But not something I was looking for when I started, and certainly wasn't a great week.
Yeah. All right. So should we move on from from the federal ass pounding that everybody took last week and talk about the report, talk about what's new and you know what your outlook is going forward?
Sure. Let's deconstruct the report, because you said something that I agree with, which is, you know, one of the paths to truly slaying Tesla Q would be for Elon to sustainably create economic value, to use the resources allocated to him to earn a return above his cost of capital sustainably year after year,
right?
As opposed to just one, I would say, heavily managed quarter to show a surprise profit to burn the shorts, which is what I strongly believe happened here. Now, I will say, until we get the 10Q, it's going to be difficult to fully reconstruct all of the levers that were pulled to show this profit in Q3. And one of the things that I think is important for your listeners to know, maybe those that haven't worked in a large corporation or are familiar with sort of how public companies work, there's a huge amount of management discretion in GAAP accounting. You can have two different management teams look at the exact same series of financial activities over a 90-day period and produce radically different 10-Qs. Management discretion basically is the judgment of management as it pertains to whether or not certain expenses and or revenue should be recognized in this period, accruals, and so on. And I think the difference between Tesla's Q2 financials and their Q3 financials is proof of just how much management discretion there is. Because in reality, Tesla's revenue went down $50 million, which is, you know, maybe a percent. But their net income to the bottom line skyrocketed 800 basis points. Said another way, they delivered 1,800 more cars than they did in Q2 at lower price and at a higher sort of lease percentage, a percentage of cars that were leased, which led those, I think it's the combination of those two things that contributed to the sequential revenue decline. So revenue goes down $50 million. Deliveries are only up 1,800 on a base of what, 95,000 in Q2. So from 95,000 to 97,000 on 1,800 deliveries, he delivered sequentially $550 million more net income straight to the bottom line. And if you think that those two statements accurately reflect the difference between the financial activities in quarter two versus quarter three, then you should go long Tesla stock. I personally don't believe it. And I think when the 10Q comes out, Tesla Q, which is an amazing, distributed, highly intelligent, crowdsourced FinTwit experiment, is going to pull that 10Q apart within minutes. But we do already have some good leads. And so, you know, when you just do the waterfall from Q2 to Q3 and see where the differences are, you can begin to pull the thread on what might have happened. But a couple of the big ones, other income was a $140 million swing sequentially. So what's in other income? If you read the 10Q from last quarter or the 10Ks, other income swung $126 million. It was a $40 million in change headwind that turned into an $80 million in change tailwind in the quarter. In other income is predominantly the impact of currency and interest rate swaps. And every single currency of consequence went against Tesla in Q3. The Norwegian currency, where they have a lot of sales, got a lot weaker. The Chinese currency famously got a lot weaker. The euro a little bit weaker. The one currency that should help them, which is the Japanese yen, because that's where a lot of their costs come from the battery packs, from all S and X. That currency got stronger, which is a move against Tesla. Every single currency of consequence moved against Tesla, and somehow other income swung $126 million quarter over quarter, which represents about 90% of their reported profit. another big wedge that we should have seen coming, to be honest with you, is restructuring. So Tesla took a $117 million restructuring charge in Q2 that didn't repeat in Q3. And for those that aren't familiar, one of the nice ways to bake a quarter is to take a bunch of restructuring charges and then put some of your expenses in the quarter into that bucket. So mm-hmm. it's not just that they didn't take a restructuring charge. They had a nice restructuring piggy bank to put some coins in that might otherwise show up on the income statement. So that's sort of a double tailwind. And then who knows what else they've done. All I know is they sold basically the same number of cars at a lower price in the face of substantial currency headwinds and more complex logistics. And they claim to have swung profit $550 million sequentially. I have some very strong opinions and ideas as to what motivated them to kitchen sink the quarter to the plus side, but I'll stop there and maybe we can see.
Well, I'll just say, you know, for people that are not finance people, I'll just say that what he's talking about, the 10Q, is basically the comprehensive document that you're required to file with the Securities and Exchange Commission every quarter. So you report your earnings on a quarterly basis. Three times a year, you file a 10Q document. And once a year, you file a 10K document, which is a lengthier disclosure uh-huh. that you do once per year. And so when a company goes out and releases earnings, like Tesla released earnings on Wednesday, the 10Q isn't due at the same time that the earnings press release goes out. So you're able to kind of get this headline snapshot of the numbers that Tesla was able to release on Wednesday of this week. But the comprehensive document that lays out things like accounting changes, that you know lays out the financial statements in detail, that offers management's discussion and analysis, any type of new legal proceedings, things of that nature, this comprehensive document has not yet been filed with the SEC. And so what Mr. Charts is saying here is that he's anxiously awaiting the filing of that document as he thinks it might shed light as to the, you know, huge change in the company's numbers from a quarter-to-quarter basis. So in essence, you know, you have a company here that's been selling 100 glasses of lemonade every quarter and has been consistently unable to turn a profit in doing so. And all of a sudden this quarter they sell, you know, 90 glasses of lemonade and their profit swings from, you know, a $50 loss to a $50 profit. And you're wondering, well, what did they do different in between selling and counting their money at the end of the day that's allowing them to post this huge profit number? What's kind of happening in the works there? And that's what we're hoping to gain visibility on through the 10Q.
And then let's just give him the absolute total benefit of the doubt. Let's just say this is the cleanest numbers you've ever seen.
Sure.
The stock went up, what, $80? That's, what, $15 billion in market cap for a net profit to the bottom line of less than $150 million. $143 million net income available to common shareholders, which, by the way, makes Tesla a 2.2% net margin company that has a lot of debt, is asset intense, needs a lot of capital to grow, and is facing an onslaught of competition.
And is still and has still posted reset. A loss this year, a total loss this year of what, $900 million maybe?
Yeah, that was the other point. And so there's no question that management has substantial discretion as it pertains to the quarterly changes in sort of how and what expenses to recognize and revenue. One of the ways to harmonize that out is to look at multiple quarters together. And so if you just look at the numbers for the year 9 months ended September 30th, 2019, yeah, they've the net income or loss available to common stockholders is a loss of $967 million on total revenues of $17 billion. So basically, they lost $1 billion on $17 billion in revenue. Now, the counter to that would be you have sequential improvement throughout the quarter, and you need to draw a line from $700 million net loss in Q1 to $400 million net loss in Q2 to a $140 million profit in Q3, and that arrow is just going to go up into the right forever. Clearly, that's what's, well, I don't think any of this is baked into the stock price. I was going to say, clearly, that's what's baked into the stock price. There is no justification for the market cap, even in the most rosy scenario. And eventually, that will normalize, and I wouldn't be the first to admit that I would have, well, I did lose a lot of money betting that they would never see 300 again, but here we are. Could have been a lot worse. For the first time, I almost wrote naked calls. I was pretty confident that they were going to have a crappy quarter. I didn't, because I have position rules, and I didn't violate them, thankfully. But I was, you know, one mouse click away from a much larger loss than I realized, and so that was actually pretty sobering.
You hear that, Elon? If you're listening, you stuck it to Mr. Charts for the for the quarter, but he's still here. Yeah. He sounds all right too. He doesn't sound that bad.
No, I will say that's an important point. Like, I'm the first to admit, hey, Elon, you managed to screw Tesla Q this quarter. Congratulations. In some instances, that might cause people like Tesla Q to sort of stop working and just give up on the name. I don't think I see much of that. And in fact, I see, for many of the more talented Tesla Q members that have been in the name for a long time, I see a re-motivation and a recommitment to do more work. And I would say, look, it's never really been about the trade for me. I like money. I don't like losing money. It wasn't a great week. I didn't put enough in it to affect my lifestyle, because it's never been about the trade. And I think that the swings in the P&Ls from quarter to quarter only serve to prove to many suspicious members of Tesla Q that something's not right with this company. So for me, I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to work harder. I spent all night last night reading some very interesting documents that I'm sure we'll talk about later. But as it pertains to the particulars of the quarter, certainly was a bad quarter. We lost that battle. But I do think that the end result of the war is inevitable.
I mean, there's also an argument being made that, hey, if they can keep stringing together quarters like this once in a while, even if they're nonsense, even if they're if they turn out to be engineered, you know, isn't that enough? I mean, look, I have friends that like this stock, right? I have smart friends that like Tesla. They think, you know, that it's going to be acquired by Apple. They think that Musk's going to continue to find a way to do what he's been doing. And admittedly, as I said to Mark Spiegel on the last podcast I did with him, there's a fascination with this company in the sense that, from a psychology standpoint, you know, it doesn't matter, and it hasn't mattered in the past, what this company's bottom line looks like, to be honest with you. I mean, obviously, it catalyzed the short squeeze here over the last week. But if profitability was the main sticking point with this company, the stock would have been lower, you know, years ago at this point. So what I said to Spiegel when we were talking about the quarter, it was then the upcoming quarter, I talked to him a day or two before earnings, was, you know, how do you try to gauge what the market psychology is with this company when really the, as they used to say on Whose Line Is It Anyway, the points don't matter. And you could make a very strong brand equity type argument that some of my friends have about, you know, this could be a takeover target for a company like Apple. And I try to think about that honestly. And I understand the Tesla situation. I understand that they're highly levered. I understand that Musk is, in my opinion, a huge liability. I understand that they have quality issues with the cars. I understand that they're skimping on customer service to save money. And there's a lot of pissed off customers out there. I see them on social media all the time. You know, I understand that the SolarCity acquisition, that there may have been some ugly things involving that acquisition, which we'll talk about and we've talked about in the past. I think I have a pretty good idea of rounding out most of the bear case from a bird's eye view. And on the other hand, I think, you know, well, $60 billion is nothing to a company like Apple. And I think about a company like Apple who is struggling for innovation right now. And that's one of the big headlines. You know, Johnny Ive just left or is leaving the company. You know, they've really been unable to generate any new buzz on any new products. They're a company that would ostensibly be hungry to look into another industry. Yes, it's a capital-intensive industry. Yes, they would incur significant liabilities. But if anybody could do it, a company like they could do it, and they could do it under the guise of, you know, we want the first mover advantage, and we want the brand equity that goes with the name. So when I think about that, and that's not some, you know, retail peckerwood that gave me that idea, that talked to me about it like this. This is a real guy who manages real money.
Yeah. Yeah, I get that.
So I'd be interested in your thoughts on that, especially given what we've seen here.
Lots to unpack. I thought a lot about WeWork and Tesla and Adam Neumann versus Elon, you know, and the analogy I was thinking about, which sort of feeds into your question, which is, you know, why did, let's use an analogy that Elon would be familiar with. Why did Adam Neumann's rocket blow up on the launch pad while Elon is still flying high? And then your question is there a scenario where Elon could reach escape velocity on fraud, you know, outrun mm-hmm. all of the fancy stuff?
That's a great analogy.
I would say anybody who is betting on the imminent demise of Tesla, you know, that was a real thing last year. And I think when all of the documents from whatever lawsuits flow out of all of the activities from last year, the 420 tweet, and is going to show that Tesla Q was dead right. This company was on the verge of insolvency. And, you know, Elon is a fighter, and he bluffed and fought his way out. And then I think, again, in the first quarter in late February, they were insolvent. They had to get some alternative funding going and barely managed to survive Q1, I believe. And then they raised money in May. So when they raised money in May, I think sort of the imminent bankruptcy play of Tesla was no longer a smart trade. And some would argue it was never a smart trade because companies with that equity value can always raise. And clearly Elon did raise, but he had some issues with the SEC. He was charged with securities fraud. He settled that case. He was charged with contempt of court for violating a settlement. He hadn't resolved all of that in Q1 when demand was very weak and logistics were screwed up, and he had a major bond payment due. And there were questions as to whether or not he would be able to make that payment. You know, like I would say that Tesla Q did a pretty good job of sniffing out the fact that this company was on the brink of solvency. The company is no longer on the brink of solvency, and anybody who's trading it shouldn't. Although, again, I don't give investment advice. Do what you want with your money. But I'm personally not making any kind of bets where, hey, you know, if Tesla goes bankrupt in the next few months, I'm going to make a huge score. Like, I think that's been taken off the table with the raise in May. They claim to have $5 billion of cash on the balance sheet. And at $330 a share, Elon is in a much better position to go ahead and raise more equity capital than he was at $240 a share back in May when he raised. And so there's no question that he can keep diluting stock. And there is value in Tesla. You know, this Zach from Clean Technica wrote a hit piece on the Tesla Charts account, so basically on me, before earnings last week. And I since DM'd with him, and he's a nice enough guy, and I think we, you know, in a different world where we didn't have this disagreement on Tesla, we might get along. We have similar thoughts around the importance of green energy and renewable energy. But basically, you know, he said Tesla Charts ascribes a zero value to the company, which isn't true. My long-term price target for the equity within the context of the current cap table is zero. But I do think there's substantial value in Tesla. There's no question that the brand, if the company, you know, persists, is strong. I would argue that if the company collapsed, that would destroy the brand value with it. I would argue the single most valuable thing in Tesla is the customer list, because never has there been a group of people more willing to take abuse from a company. Per your point about, you know, reliability, inability to get service, 1,000+ people in a Facebook group about terrible paint jobs on their Model 3. We're going to see a lot more of that as the second winter turns and there's more and more cars on the road. But there's no question that there is, as Jonas would say, strategic value potentially inside of Tesla. Now let's walk through the math. I would put the odds of Apple acquiring Tesla at roughly zero.
I don't think you can put it at zero, though. You can't put, put anything at zero or 100%.
Yeah.
I learned that a long time ago.
All right. I said roughly
so
zero.
let's say 5%.
Okay.
Would you say 5%?
I think 5% is too high. Of course, on Monday, I'll wake up to the headline that Apple is buying Tesla, and then I can come on and get another reaming from you. but I do think it's a very low probability.
Sure.
If you just look in the history of Apple, I think their biggest acquisition was Beats.
Yeah.
They just don't acquire. They have an enormous war chest. And if they were to acquire, why would you acquire all the things you talk about? You know, there's enormous liabilities here. I think the balance sheet is in far worse shape than the numbers just tell you. All of the future liability of fixing all of these cars. You know, if you were to operate Tesla in the way that most executives would operate a company, the numbers would look a lot worse. I think there's a proactive strategy to minimize serving these cars, push off the expenses. There's anecdotal evidence on Twitter of them charging for what should be warranty work. There's lawsuits out, you know, from top to bottom all across the company. I just think that if you're Apple and you want to get into the car business, there's easier ways to do it. And I just don't think you said, you know, Apple could easily spend $60 billion. If we woke up on Monday and it was announced that Apple was buying Tesla, what do you think would happen to Apple stock?
Oh, we crater.
And all the executives at Apple, what is their number one form of compensation?
I'm sure it's stock-based.
Yeah. And more than that, I'm sure it's option in stock.
Sure, and but the stock is at all-time highs. Apple's at all-time highs. You know, they could do so. That means their currency is worth more. They could do the acquisition partly in stock. You would be buying. The reason to buy Tesla instead of buying, you know, the easier ways to get into the industry is you're buying Elon Musk. You're buying Tesla. You're buying you're buying that PR.
Yeah, I would put a very low price on the value of that asset, Elon. But let me tell you what is, I think, the primary. So I started by saying that I think the odds of Apple outright acquiring Tesla are very low. I said roughly zero. You said let's put it at less than five. We'll go with your number. There is a path that I think is more worrisome to Tesla bears. I'm surprised he hasn't done it. There must be a reason he hasn't done it. I don't know what that reason is, but a strategic partnership with another automotive company that has the dealership network and the procurement excellence that could help them with manufacturing would make a lot more sense. But then again, you know, Elon would have to give up control, and what company, how are they going to value, you know, the Tesla stock? It would hurt probably that incumbent. But, you know, if Volkswagen and Tesla signed a strategic partnership, and you know, you could then go to a Volkswagen dealer to buy your Tesla, and you could go to a Volkswagen dealer to service Tesla.
Yeah,
that's the kind of thing where, you know, maybe they take a 25% stake in Tesla. Elon maintains control. Like I do think. No, I happen to think that given what I think is going on inside that company, such a deal would not survive due diligence. But that's just an opinion. If you're asking me what is the sort of biggest risk to a Tesla short, it's that. It's a strategic partnership where the automotive manufacturer that they partner with brings the assets and capability Tesla needs to reach escape velocity.
Well, I got to tell you that something like that would change my view. I've toyed with the idea about getting a Tesla. As a matter of fact, I have a friend of mine who is very well off, who is bullish on the company, who offered to buy me a Model 3. He's like, "You want one? You know, like take it out, drive it. You know, would you drive it if I bought it for you?" And I was like, "I don't fucking think so." And the reason why is I know people can say, "Oh, you're stupid for turning down." I don't want to have to fucking deal with it. You know, my car now is an Acura. It's a Honda. I know how it works. I know how to change the oil. I know where the dealerships are. I know my mechanic knows it. I know the tire you know, sizes are standard. I know everything about it. You know, it snaps apart and snaps together very easily. I can do shit on it by myself if I need to. And one of the big reasons that I would just not want to drive a Tesla is because I'd be constantly driving around waiting for something to break. And when it broke, I would be worried. I'd be driving around worried, just even going to get my morning coffee. Like, is this the fucking morning that the battery malfunctions or the fucking software freezes up or something like that happens? And then what am I going to do? You know, I'm not going to take it to fucking Rocco, my mechanic out here, who's going to look at him, you know, hey, we don't look at these electric pieces of shit, you know, get a real fucking car, faggot, you know? I don't want to have to do that. But if there was a service network that had been incorporated into an existing group of dealerships, that might change the way I think about that. Now, you say you don't think a partnership deal would survive due diligence. And again, for those uninitiated in finance, you know, when a major company looks to take a partnership in another company, or they look to potentially make an acquisition, you know, part of what they do in preparation for that is they have to, usually they'll hire an outside firm, like an investment bank, to come in and look at the potential targets, financials, and go deeper than you would see in a SEC filed report. There's non-disclosure agreements that are signed, you know, accounting journal entries get looked at. Things go one iteration deeper than they would from just examining a company's public documents. You know, they're going to be on site making visits. They're going to be looking at things firsthand. And what you're saying is, you know, you don't think that a potential partnership like that would survive that type of rigorous examination of the company. Is that right?
It'd be a substantial risk. And, you know, the counter argument to my sort of, to that scenario that I laid out is it's too late. The cost to set up all of these dealers to service Tesla would be prohibitive.
Right.
Tesla doesn't have the capacity to make all the parts it needs to properly service the cars. And then on top of that, if you do partner with a respectable OEM, they're never going to pull the shenanigans that Tesla has had to pull in order to bake these quarters. Like, they're never going to turn away customers, make it impossible to talk to somebody to sign, you know, to get an appointment to fix your car. They wouldn't put cars of this quality on the road in the first place.
Yeah. It would be a significant drain on their resources.
Yeah, and that's what I mean by forget about all of the bombs that are inside, you know, the due diligence stuff. But if you are talking about what is the greatest headline risk, I've always had that fear in the back of my mind that a GM, a Ford, somebody sort of, maybe they have their own troubles with their own. Because, by the way, like, people throw in my face all the time on Twitter before I block them that, you know, well, look at Ford, look at GM, you know, the Ford's going bankrupt. Like, I'm not long those companies. The auto business sucks. One of the reasons why Tesla attracts so many shorts to begin with is the auto business sucks.
Right.
It's capital intense. You can't earn your cost of capital across the cycle. As Elon famously says, every company except Ford and Tesla has gone bankrupt. I don't think you'll be able to say either of those things are true in 10 years. Yeah. The auto business is a terrible business from an investor perspective. And so, you know, it is what it is. It's just, when I think about sort of the fear is, you know, Ford as a Hail Mary, and to cut a deal with Tesla, and we're going to bring Ford's manufacturing excellence and solve that problem. And we have this wide dealer network, and look, it's doable. It might survive diligence. It's far, far, far more likely that that happens than Apple outright acquires Tesla at the current valuation plus a premium. So, ironically, I think the higher the stock price, the less likely any of these deals can happen, because the valuation is just ridiculous. The longer a deal like this doesn't happen, the more imperiled the company becomes. And so, in a perverse way, the recent short squeeze, I don't like to call it a short burn. Somebody on Twitter called it a thermal event, which I prefer to use, using Elon's language for when things blow up. You know, the higher the stock goes, the more emboldened he becomes, the more I think arrogant he would be about doing a partnership or admitting the need for it, the less likely it is that he'll do it. And then you'll have, I think, this cascading series of events that ultimately leads to the company's downfall. And by the way, you know, we tipped our hat to Elon this week. Congratulations. Yes, you know, you burned Shorty. All of the Tesla bulls that have been dreaming of this short squeeze forever are piling into the stock, and you see reports on TMC of people putting 100% of their IRA in now that Shorty's burned, you know.
Right.
You know, one thing is pretty certain. My suspicion, I said pretty certain, it's too strong. I suspect Elon is more than capable of overplaying his hand. And one of the things that gives me comfort is I think when he's emboldened, he makes mistakes. And, you know, on Friday in many ways was worse than Thursday for a lot of people. It wasn't for me because it might, you know, to the extent that a long put position can't be worth less than zero. That position was worked out already on Thursday.
Right.
But for people that were short the stock or maybe short some calls or call spreads or whatever, Friday, I think, was even more painful than Thursday. And what happened in the middle of the day on Friday, of course, is Elon tweets a fire emoji in the middle of the trading day. And that sort of poured gasoline on the short squeeze. And that was, I think, a message to all the Tesla longs. Let's go ahead and press the gas. And then Ross Gerber, who's basically not afraid to admit what looks like stock manipulation on Twitter, says, we're just buy to squeeze Shorty. We're trying to drive the stock price up with our purchases. Effectively, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but you saw the tweet.
I did.
What a stupid tweet. And so, yeah, you know, Elon, who is supposed to have a Twitter sitter, tweets a fire emoji in the middle of the trading day to try to engineer yet another short squeeze. You know why? Because Elon cares more about vengeance than running his company well.
Well, you're making a lot of assumptions there. He tweeted a fire emoji. Let's give him the benefit of the doubt again.
Yeah.
You know, we don't know.
Maybe he was talking
about
battery.
Maybe, yeah, maybe he was sparking one up. I mean, we don't know why he tweeted a fire emoji. But but yes, that was certainly the first thing I thought of when I saw it too. I was like, all right, this is a, you know, this is a sign.
Well, I mean, it's pretty okay. Let's look at the evidence. Was he sparking one up? I don't know. I don't know if he uses drugs. There's lots of talks about that, but I've never sort of made that accusation. I don't think, other than in a few jokes, like some photoshops. But he's talked about the short burn of the century.
Right.
Stock was in the middle of a five sigma move on Thursday and another big move up on Friday.
Right.
And in the middle of the trading day, there's no way that a respectable, responsible executive would spike the football like that.
Right.
You wouldn't take a chance. He knows at a minimum that that's how it could be interpreted before
right.
he tweeted it. And if he doesn't know that, then he's not the brain genius that he claims to be. But I actually think he's smart enough to know exactly what he did.
Right.
And he did it. I mean, like, it's. I would put a very high probability that he put that tweet out on purpose to burn Shorty.
I wouldn't disagree with you. I wouldn't disagree with you.
And that's fine. Spike the football. My whole point is that's a perfect example of impulse control issues, where he's going to overplay what he thinks is a strong hand. That's my prediction.
Right.
We'll see. Maybe suddenly a lightning bolt of maturity will strike Elon and he will become a statesman, a scholar.
So be the time to do it right now if he could, you know, if he ever wanted to clean up his act in that regard, this would be the time to do it now. I mean, look, they made a nice new PowerPoint presentation of their shareholder letter. Did you see? I was like, oh, maybe this is, you know, maybe Kirkhorn is the mature one, has come in here and tried to turn over a new leaf. And we got through the conference call without any major disasters from the end of the company. So who knows, man? Who knows? But then
I did notice that they put a PowerPoint out, but I was too busy looking at my Bloomberg terminal at a vertical line.
Right.
The stock price reaching escape velocity on a rocket, you know. So.
Well, the, you know, just to go back on, kind of talking about Elon's petulance and the way that he's carried himself, this Solar City deposition that has been released on Twitter, I think courtesy of the guys over at Plainsight, has certainly been a fascinating read. And also, the company had another solar reveal planned for Friday. So as we move from talking about earnings on Wednesday to the ensuing squeeze on Friday, we got kind of two new things that I was wondering if you could talk about. The first was the company had you know, a version 3 of their solar roof tile reveal that was supposed to happen. Granted, you know, I'm not sure when version 1 or 2 ever happened, but apparently they did at some point. And then also we got this deposition from the Solar City lawsuit that me and you talked about the last time you were on. You can go back and check out that podcast. I think it's in the 140s. And so give me your thoughts on those things. I mean, as the resident solar expert, let's hear it.
Yeah. Well, I would say before we jump into the details, because it is an amazing thing, I think they're related. I think the...
Oh, is that right?
I believe that the... What I suspect we'll find was a highly engineered third quarter was driven by the need to get ahead of this document drop that our friend Aaron Span over at PlainSight was able to pull off. And Aaron put out a great thread yesterday, basically detailing the history of how that happened. So for your listeners who aren't familiar or maybe didn't listen to the last podcast, there's a major shareholder derivative lawsuit going on in the Delaware courts, basically arguing that the Solar City transaction was a related party bailout. And that's a very dangerous lawsuit to Elon personally. And so that lawsuit took deposition in the early summer, and then Elon had a second round in August. And then Aaron over at PlainSight put in a request to publicize that docket, and that request went in on September 19th of this year. And I think that, you know, the documents, and we'll talk a lot about them hopefully, are very, very, very damning. Elon had to know they were damning, and I think it is part of the reason why they did the earnings when they did and how they did them. So on September 19th, PlainSight basically puts in this request. The documents were supposed to come out before this Friday. Tesla snuck in a request for an extension, and the judge didn't give Aaron a chance to comment on it. That extension was to, guess what, October 24th, which was Thursday. So they moved earnings to Wednesday, the 23rd, after knowing these documents were the 24th.
Is that right? And then when did they move earnings? Did they actually move the date?
They didn't move earnings. They set the date for October 23rd, okay. Which coincidentally
important
is the day before.
There. Go ahead.
No question. Yep. Thank you. That's what I meant to say. So I'm trying to be precise. But Tesla knew that this, what I believe will turn out to be very damning document drop, was going to come out on the 24th. They scheduled their earnings on the 23rd. And magically, total coincidence, they scheduled the reveal of solar, the solar version 3 tile, you know, the solar roof tile that we've talked about before, for the 24th.
Right.
And then the documents actually didn't come out until Friday, and they moved the solar reveal to Friday after market close.
Right. That I remember they did. They moved the date of the – it was supposed to be Thursday for the solar roof tile reveal, and then they moved to Friday, right.
Yes. And then in the intervening time, when it became clear to Tesla that Aaron Greenspan knew enough to figure out how to pay $200 and get all these documents dropped – I would say that Aaron has been the victim of an onslaught of harassment and hate, the likes of which I wouldn't wish upon anybody. Could be a total coincidence. I don't want to get into the details because I know that relevant authorities have been contacted on some of the more extreme components of this harassment, but it's pretty bad and quite the coincidence. So this document dropped on Friday. And I have spent the better part of the weekend reading as much of it as I can, but it's a very, very big document drop. You can go to PlainSight. Of course, the most interesting document is Elon's deposition, which is basically published almost in full. There is some redactions. It looks like all the redactions have to do with SpaceX. But if you go to the Tesla Charts Twitter account, I've replaced my pinned tweet with a link to a clean PDF of that deposition. And I have to say it's very, very interesting reading. And so in this lawsuit, shareholders are suing the directors and Elon, arguing that the Tesla acquisition of SolarCity was a bailout of an insolvent entity and shouldn't have happened. and that the board members were hopelessly conflicted. And so the documents consist of all of the depositions and then the associated evidence, emails and things like that, that come with it. And so I'll stop there and see where you want to go with it. But I've read Elon's deposition. I've read Jason Wheeler's deposition, who was the former CFO, who kind of quit in a strange way after about a year and a half. I've read Kimball's deposition, which is a real funny one. So where do you want me to take it?
Well, look, I think you made the important points to those who are uninitiated here, right? Which is, this is a relatively serious lawsuit. It alleges that Tesla bailed out SolarCity. You know, the executives of SolarCity, obviously related parties. The CEO was the cousin of Elon Musk. The company was arguably on the brink of bankruptcy, on the brink of insolvency, and Tesla just swooped in and acquired it. And the question here is whether or not that acquisition was good for already existing Tesla shareholders. Did it make sense for them? Were these directors acting in the best interest of people who already own Tesla stock by packaging this insolvent, really pile of shit into their Tesla shares? Or, you know, was it an accretive or a dilutive acquisition? From what I read, Kimball Musk doesn't seem to understand what those terms mean, but I'm assuming that you guys do. Was it good or was it bad for the company? And if it was if it was bad for the company, then why did the transaction take place? And so what Mr. Charts is talking about here is the deposition, which is the questioning between the, you know, the lawyers and the parties involved. The transcripts of those depositions have been made public, and in them, a lot of little nuggets of information, which I'll let you talk about as, you know, in the order that you'd like.
Sure. Let's start with Elon's deposition, which if you're a long investor in Tesla and you think I'm full of it and you think Tesla Q is some giant big oil conspiracy funded by the Koch brothers, still waiting for my first check from the Koch brothers. I would encourage you to go to my pinned tweet, download the PDF, there's part one and part two, and just read it. And you tell me what's wrong with this man. It is a stunning document. The thing that jumps out of it when you read it is just how petulant and angry he is to even have to sit down and explain himself.
Right.
He's a very, very angry man, and very he just attacks this attorney relentlessly throughout the deposition in a way that's really stunning, you know. And what normally happens is this attorney that interviewed him, trying to look for his name, Mr. Barron, I believe. This is a really smart guy, right? And you could tell as he sort of has a long windup in a series of questions, as a reader, you can sort of see where he's going. And then you could see the moment where Elon realizes what this guy's up to. And then suddenly Elon goes into, I don't recall, I don't recall, I don't recall, and then starts attacking the attorney personally, randomly, and basically refuses to answer the questions. Simple questions that any other CEO should be able to handle with no issue. At one point, he randomly asks the guy if he drives a gasoline car. And the guy says, yes, I do. He said, well, why don't you drive an electric car? Why do you hate the environment?
Yeah, you can afford it, right?
You can afford it. Is it an Audi? Is it a Mercedes? And the attorney just keeps asking the question that he wants Elon to answer. And Elon keeps going back, do you have solar? And so I guess, you know, the fact that I drive a plug-in hybrid Chevy Volt, maybe Elon will hate me a little bit less than I'm sure he does. But it's very clear, when you read the deposition, that Elon sort of has trouble keeping all of the things he thinks he's supposed to say in order because these things conflict, right? And so just at the beginning, let's lay out a fact. Since Tesla acquired SolarCity, the SolarCity business has cratered. It just has. And so I'm just pulling out some numbers while we talk because I have my computer in front of me. In the fourth quarter of 2015, SolarCity deployed 253 megawatts of solar power. And that was their peak. That was their high watermark. By the time Tesla bought them in Q4, they were down to about 200 megawatts for the quarter installed. That was basically a steady downward decay to Q2 2019, where they did only 29 megawatts. So 85% decline in the business from the peak of Q4 2015 to last quarter. The first couple pages of this deposition is this attorney trying to get Elon to admit that the solar megawatts deployed has gone down. And he won't. And then basically at some point, after a long windup, he eventually just flat out says, no, I don't think the business has deteriorated in a material way. It's really amazing. I'm staring at this chart. The business is down 85%, and Elon won't admit on her oath that the business has gone down since the acquisition. So the deposition is filled with all kinds of nuggets like that. It's very clear, I think, from the totality of the evidence that SolarCity was in a massive liquidity crisis and needed to be bailed out. And ironically, Elon insists that the reason why the solar business may have struggled a little bit is because he had to redeploy all the resources to make the Model 3. So that's his big defense in this document is
right.
If due to the Model 3, we would be bankrupt. And the attorney is basically trying to nail him down to say he knew or should have known in 2016 when he was doing his acquisition that the Model 3 was going to be a problem. And why did you do the acquisition if you knew the Model 3 was going to be a problem? And the reason is you had to, which we can talk about later. So Elon's deposition is worth the read. If you're long the stock and you read that deposition from start to finish, and then you're still long the stock, you know, God bless you. Good luck.
Yeah, it's an interesting kind of, it's like when they pull those cylinders of ice out of the glaciers to check out what the trapped little bits of atmosphere in them contain, in the sense that, you know, the deposition took place months ago, took place a while ago, so we're getting a kind of a after the fact look into what his mind set was like when the deposition was taken, and furthermore, if he's to be believed, we're getting an even deeper look into kind of what was going through his head at the time of the acquisition, or so he claims. And so it's very interesting to kind of look back, and you know, we're getting this snapshot of what's going on in his head. And I know certainly people skeptical of the company are constantly wondering what is going on in his head, which is what makes this deposition extremely fascinating, because he's being questioned by somebody who's obviously skeptical of what he has to say.
Well, yeah, he's the attorney. That's his job. I would say that there's two reasons why this is fascinating. It's very fascinating for me because this was my realization story. This is how I came to Tesla Q, and how I ultimately decided to do Tesla Charts was because I was very, very skeptical of this related party transaction, and I thought it stunk. And in particular, when I watched the SolarCity reveal, the solar roof reveal, Elon showed the solar shingle, and I told you last time, and these documents basically prove that that was a fake product. And I see no distinction between the solar shingle reveal and Elizabeth Holmes, you know, blood test device. I think they're the same thing.
So let's stop and let's talk about that real quick, because on the last podcast we did, me and you, which is, and I'm going to get the number here just so people know exactly where to go to. We did QTR 145, which was September 10th of this year. So the last time we talked, and if you want all the backstory to this shit, you can go back and listen to that one about why you, you know, why you became a skeptic in the first place. But one of the things that you have said is you thought that the original solar tile roof reveal was fake. You thought it was a fake product. It didn't exist, and that they were being, you know, the public and shareholders were being pitched something that simply didn't exist. And now you're saying now you're saying that this new document dump lends credence to that. Talk about that.
Yeah, so I'll jump to Jason Wheeler's deposition. So Jason Wheeler is the former CFO of Tesla. And weirdly, a young guy, after only a year and a half at Tesla, resigned very shortly after the SolarCity merger was complete. And it's pretty clear from the documents and his testimony that he opposed this merger, didn't think it was the right thing for Tesla. That may be part of the reason why he left. You know, if you're the CFO and the CEO makes a strategic decision like that that you agree with, one of the things to do is resign. He resigned. When he resigned, he said he wanted to go spend time with family, which is fine. That's his prerogative. So very interestingly, at the very end of his deposition, I'll just read it. So the attorney says, question. So I get a sense of timing. I know you understood that it was a future nascent product by the time it was incorporated. Were you of the view, even before the merger agreement was signed, that there was no real product yet to model? Answer from Jason Wheeler, yes. I think before it was signed, that's what I was thinking. Basically, the attorney is asking him, hey, where in the financials is this amazing product that's going to revolutionize this business and is the is one of the primary drivers of the merger? And the CFO of Tesla is saying under oath that they're nowhere in the financials, and in his mind, it didn't exist. If you go back to Elon's deposition, the very last question the attorney asks him, series of questions, this is the attorney asking Elon, question, and that the moving up of the launch event was specifically in response to feedback from major investors that were very negative on SolarCity, correct? Answer, yes. Question, and you believed you needed to do this to show them what the integrated product looks like, correct? Answer, yes. And I've seen the original email now. Somebody in TeslaCube dug it out and published it this morning. That's basically verbatim from the email. The investor feedback on the SolarCity deal was negative for good reason. That deal was, I believe, a related party bailout of an insolvent company using Tesla shares as the currency to do that. The depositions are very consistent with that. Whether they win or lose the lawsuit, I think the evidence is pretty clear. And then, you know, I think the most damning thing I found in all of it so far, which I tweeted about last night, is this Kimball Musk deposition.
Oh, Christ.
And I'm not sure if you've had a chance to read it, but here's the thing that most of your listeners may not understand, and the reason why I believe Elon cares so much about the stock price and the fact that he cares so much about the stock price drives suboptimal behavior from a long-term shareholder perspective. This entire family, Elon, Kimball, his brother Kimball, his cousin Lyndon Reeve, who's the CEO of SolarCity, they had all pledged their stock for loan. And so, you know, they don't want to sell their stock either because they don't want to send the signal to the market that they don't believe in the future, or they don't want to lose voting control of their stock. And so what they do is they pledge their stock in exchange for loans. And that collateral of your stock rises and falls with the stock price. And one of the big challenges for executives who do that is if the stock price falls, they have to meet a margin call. So if I've pledged, if I'm Kimball and I've pledged my SolarCity stock for a loan at Morgan Stanley
To start a carrot farm.
Yeah, well, you know, he started, let's be fair, you know, he started the kitchen and he's got a business. And
I know, you know I'm and, just you know, fucking around.
And I'll just take a time out. When I read the deposition, of all the depositions I read, I just wanted to give him a hug when it was done. You know, he seems like a nice guy. He's caught up in Elon's whirlwind. He certainly benefited from it. He's become wealthy because of it. But he does seem like a nice guy that's just a little bit in over his head.
Out of his league, yeah, exactly.
A little out of his league. But here's the most damning thing that I think is really quite stunning, and I tweeted it last night. Because he had pledged his SolarCity stock for loans, and Elon had as well, and Elon had pledged his Tesla stock, and then we can maybe talk later, there's a really interesting juicy nugget in there about Elon pledging his SpaceX stock. That I believe was not known prior to yesterday when it was found in this document dump. So Kimball had pledged his SolarCity stock for a loan, and SolarCity was cratering. Again, Elon knew at the end of 2015, and the SolarCity senior management knew that SolarCity was heading for a liquidity crisis. and there were big problems there. And so by the time January and February 2016 roll around, Kimball is getting margin calls on a SolarCity loan. And in order to meet those margin calls, he is increasing the borrowing on his Tesla pledged stock loan. So there's lots of email correspondence between Kimball and his personal CFO, the person that runs his money. On February 8th, SolarCity stock is going down. I suspect it's because they had, you know, announced earnings or were about to announce earnings, but the stock is down. And Kimball gets a second margin call that I have been able to pull out from the documents, but a major margin call on February 8th. On February 9th, the stock drops, I think, another 30%, SolarCity stock. And he gets a note, I call it the frowny face email, from his personal CFO saying, hey, SolarCity stock is down to, you know, $18 a share. His margin kicked in at like 30. He's in deep margin call territory now, for sure. And just pulling up the specifics. Yeah, SolarCity was down 30% to under $18 on February 9th. You know, there will likely be a very large call tomorrow, probably 1 million. We will satisfy that with the Tesla line. So February 8th, he gets a margin call. February 9th, he gets a margin call. What happens on February 10th? Magically, Elon decides, much to the surprise of the Tesla team, that he is going to accelerate the schedule of the Model 3 launch. And he is going to begin taking deposits on the Model 3 starting March 31st, and just puts it out there on Twitter. And of course, this causes the Tesla stock to skyrocket. On February 10th, it was trading around $140 a share. And by the end of February, you know, 2 weeks later, the stock is trading at $195 a share. That's, you know, 30% jump in a couple of weeks. That 30% jump really helps Kimball out, because his Tesla line is based, you know, in part on the price of the Tesla stock and how much he can borrow. And so maybe it's all just a coincidence. Maybe the fact that Elon's brother was facing a margin call of serious consequence because his SolarCity stock was declining on February 9th just happens that on February 10th, Elon, to the surprise of his team, announces to the world that he's so confident that the Model 3 is going to be great that he's pulling it forward. It's also really important that Tesla, it's really important to understand that Tesla was in a very hard spot in Q1 of 2016 itself. The stock was going down. If you read Ed Niedermeyer's book, Ludicrous, they're choking on the Model X and operational execution issues surrounding the Model X in real time at the same time. And so, you know, it's tidbits like that, that as we piece all this together, I think it's become very clear to people what really happened here. And I think Elon's anger during the deposition and Elon, you know, knowing that Aaron Greenspan was going to dump these documents or facilitate the publication of these documents, I think all of this is related. I really do. And, you know, you might say, hey, you don't know that. And it's true that I don't know that. But I knew a lot about what's proven to be true in the SolarCity deal. And I'm predicting that in 18 months, when all the documents associated with 420 come out, we're going to learn a lot about what happened there. And when the documents come out for whatever is going to happen this year, we're going to be proven right. None of this, by the way, is going to have any impact on the stock price, if you ask me, if history is any guide. So if anybody is reading these documents and thinking, boy, this is really going to crater the stock, I think you have false hopes. It's not trading advice. Do what you want. I would be surprised on Monday if the release of these documents had any negative impact on the stock price whatsoever.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly, look, if the actual acquisition in and of itself didn't make a profound impact, I don't think these will either. You know, if you're not appalled by the fact that the acquisition took place, and judging by the company stock price, I mean, it was kind of there was some criticism around when it happened, and then people kind of just forgot about it, you know. And that was the same time that the amount of megawatts deployed, you know, from the company was starting to kind of whittle away, and it was almost forgotten about. I mean, a year and a half later, 2 years later, you know, people just kind of forgotten about SolarCity. I mean, until these reports came out a couple months ago about these fucking things catching fire, we hadn't heard about anything involving SolarCity. And I know personally, friends of friends, you know, one of my friends' husbands, ex-husbands rather, you know, worked for SolarCity some years back when they, you know, first started recruiting. And I mean, all those people have since been laid off. You know, you walk into Best Buy, you're not accosted by these people anymore. You don't see the SolarCity trucks out anymore. I mean, kind of fell off the map for all intents and purposes. And, you know, it's a multi-billion dollar liability that Tesla shareholders have incurred, arguably, as a result of this acquisition. And now it's kind of has just kind of faded away, you know?
Well, I have a different view, and maybe one of the things I wanted to talk to you about was what I believe is sort of what I jokingly, I think when I texted you, is the grand unified theory of Tesla. And I think 2016 is the critical year that sets all of this in motion. And when you say it kind of just went away, I have a different opinion, which is there was a purposeful strategy to further distract with other things in order to make people forget about it.
Let's hear it.
So I think all of this, where we are today with Tesla, traces back to SolarCity explains everything. So let's go back. At the end of 2015, Elon and the senior leaders at SolarCity are aware that SolarCity is in a liquidity crisis. Some big names were in the short. I think Chainos was in the short at that time. I'm not sure. Don't quote me. But there were a lot of names. The shorts were circling. The company was basically insolvent. And Elon had a huge problem, as we talked about before, which is, if SolarCity goes down, SpaceX owns a lot of bonds in SolarCity. And that's probably going to imperil SpaceX. Elon has pledged his SolarCity stock for loans. He's also pledged his Tesla stock for loans. So this is a giant, as Elon himself called it, a pyramid atop which he sits. And, you know, if this goes down, the whole thing comes down. And so I think all of Elon's behavior in early 2016, throughout the year 2016, begins with this in the back of his mind. He knows, this is speculation, okay? This is a theory. It could be wrong. The evidence seems to support it. So he knows that SolarCity is in trouble, and he needs a very strong, high-priced Tesla stock to pull this deal off. And at the same time, the Model S is struggling, and so Tesla needs to raise money as well, because it's not like any of his enterprises have ever created economic profit and are self-sustaining on a cash flow basis. So he knows this is going on. And then on top of that, there's an event that most people have forgotten about that I think is really important. On January 20th of 2016, the very first known autopilot death happened in China. This wasn't reported at the time. It was only really reported that autopilot was on all the way in September in the New York Times, long after SolarCity deal was announced and Elon pulled off a raise and all this other stuff. So you have SolarCity imploding. You have autopilot death in China. Tesla needs to raise. His brother is getting margin calls, and he brings forward the Model 3. Bringing forward the Model 3 ultimately is what almost bankrupted him in 2018. And then you get to May, and there's another autopilot death, which most people think is the first autopilot death, Joshua Brown in Florida. So on May 7th, Joshua Brown is in his car, and there's a tractor trailer perpendicular to him that he doesn't see and autopilot doesn't react to, and the car slams into this tractor trailer, and tragically, Joshua Brown dies. So here's Elon selling Autopilot to the world, and the narrative around Tesla's lead in autonomy is a big part of the spin. And at that time, Elon is getting a lot of the technology from a company out of Israel called Mobileye. And Mobileye is unhappy, I believe the record shows, and Ed Niedermeyer's reporting in particular shows, that Mobileye is beginning to express loudly, Elon, that they don't like the way Autopilot is being marketed, and they might not continue to supply the technology to Tesla if things don't change. So then in the middle of all this, the deal is announced, but Tesla on May 31st, on May 19th, 2 weeks after the Josh Brown death, they raised $2 billion in equity for Tesla. Goldman Sachs is the lead underwriter. Nobody knows that Autopilot is on. The morning of the raise, coincidentally, the analyst at Goldman upgrades Tesla to a strong buy, which causes the stock to spike. It's really one. It's a, I think, a pretty dirty deal, but the deal got done. They raised the $2 billion. Tesla's solvency is assured. The stock price is still flying high because of the Model 3 reservations. And then only after that raise is done do people find out that Autopilot was, in fact, on. So then, you know, all the things we talked about, the fake solar tile to get the deal done, the deal gets done. But in the meantime, Mobileye is winding its, you know, it's getting pretty wound up about Autopilot, and they have a break. Elon says they fired Mobileye as a supplier. Mobileye has a different interpretation that they put in an SEC filing. But then, as is his way, you would think that your number one supplier of autonomous technology walking away from you because they feel you're abusing it would be bad. Elon comes out and says all Teslas now have full self-driving hardware and begins charging people for full self-driving when it doesn't exist. So I think you're seeing a pattern here. The whole empire was teetering, and you have the convergence of Model X execution, SolarCity going bankrupt, the need to convince skeptical investors that this is going to be okay. SpaceX is highly levered into SolarCity and would probably collapse if SolarCity collapses. Mobileye is walking away from Tesla because of these Autopilot deaths. All of these are existential threats to Elon, and his response is to basically, I think, gaslight. So we don't need Mobileye. We have our own technology, and we're so confident in our technology that we're going to start charging people for it, even though it's not ready yet. So all of the problems that we see from that point forward all trace back to this amazing year, 2018. The whole empire was, I think, stitched together very tenuously.
Wow. And so that's your, you know, like you said, your grand unified theory, the standard model, if you will, in your mm-hmm. In your world.
Well, think about the problems we see. We see all of these Model 3 quality issues and warranty issues. That stems from rushing the product forward, skipping a lot of testing, which they would describe as disruption. I would describe as reckless. There's a reason why the automotive industry spends a lot of time testing and making sure their tooling works before they turn it on and start production, because they know if you put couple hundred thousand cars on the road that have defects, it's going to cost you a lot more to fix it than right. It would have cost to do it right the first time. Why did he do that? He rushed it forward for a reason. All of the Autopilot issues that we're seeing, and the NHTSA and the NTSB work, all of that, I think, stemmed from the Mobileye blow up. All of this was happening in 2016 at the same time. It's really amazing. And, you know, and when people say he is a determined guy, he survived 2016. Good for him. But the full self-driving announcement was on October 19th of 2016, and the SolarCity roof reveal was on October 28th.
So let's talk about the latest version of the solar roof. We know if you want to go back and listen to 145, we can talk, you know, you can listen to your skepticism about the original solar roof reveal and what about that presentation caused you really to become a skeptic in the first place. And now, as you said, we have this conveniently timed version 3 that is supposed to be released or is supposed to be detailed by the company. Because for years, he's been saying since the original one, oh, we're perfecting it. Oh, we're working on it. We're making a lot of progress. We're coming a long way. Because people have been asking for years, when is this going to be deployed en masse? When are we going to see this on rooftops everywhere, this product that was promised years ago or was touted years ago? So now we get this, hello, the version 3 is out now. Let's talk. We finally got the maybe the consumer-ready product here that you're going to be able to see us deploy all over the place. And what did we get on Friday?
Friday was one of the strangest. Did you listen?
I actually didn't.
Okay. It was bizarre. I suspect, based on historical behavior, that Elon's team didn't know he was going to have this reveal, and he kind of just blurted it out on the call on Wednesday.
Okay.
Much to the surprise of people, which I believe is probably why it didn't happen on Thursday and they rescheduled it on Friday.
Right.
And it really wasn't, it wasn't a reveal. It was a phone call. There was no product shown. There were no slides. It was a discussion around how hard this was to do, but that they solved it and they're going to start doing this en masse. It was bizarre. If you read the transcript, and I couldn't find it and I didn't want to re-listen to it because it frustrates me to listen to it, they were basically articulating all of the problems that were widely known in the industry in 2005. It's like they rediscovered it. It's like they spend no time in the library. You know, there's an old adage when I was in graduate school, they'd say, you know, an hour in the library is worth a week in the lab. Going back and learning how everyone else failed is like step one of any new endeavor. And it right. doesn't feel like they did that. You can count me as continued skeptical. I'm still very skeptical that this product is real and is ready for deployment and is ready for prime time in the way they described it on the call. One small example. God bless him, Phil LeBeau. You would agree with me that Phil LeBeau is not the biggest skeptic of Tesla.
He's not a skeptic, that's for certain.
You know, another guy that I wouldn't mind having a beer with, seems like a nice enough guy. But you and I would say, as skeptics of Tesla, that Phil tends to give Elon and team the old benefit of the doubt, right?
The benefit of the doubt would be an understatement. I mean, he has not, with the amount of chicanery and nonsense and bullshit that's taken place over the last, you know, 4 years with this company, for somebody that reports on the company regularly to come out, and again, this is a CEO that's been accused of securities fraud. You know, you have all this ongoing litigation, you have missed timelines, you have quality issues, all of these things, all the tweets. For somebody that's been reporting on this company consistently over the last 4 years to not mention one of these things in a skeptical light. Remember when that car blew up in the Shanghai parking garage about a year ago? There was video that surfaced of a Tesla sitting in a parking garage, I believe in, it was either in China or Japan, I can't remember.
China.
But it's just sitting there, and the security footage all of a sudden shows smoke starting to billow out from underneath the car. And then all of a sudden, the car catches fire spontaneously, sitting there, parked, and just explodes. And so it was widely circulated on Twitter, and Phil LeBeau came on to report it on CNBC the next day and said, you know, hey, we're not even sure, you know, if this actually happened or if you know, instead of saying, look, this is a video of what appears to be a Tesla, you know, kept bursting into flames while it's sitting there parked, but we're still waiting to confirm the video, you know, and we'll keep you up to date on that. We get, you know, we get him saying, well, there's this thing, it's kind of being circulated on the internet, and there's a lot of rumors going around, and we don't even know if this is really, I don't even know what he said, we don't even know if this is really real. We don't even know if this is really a real video, you know? And then, of course, like 2 days later, it was confirmed that, yes, it was real, and the car blew up, and even Tesla came out and said it was a battery issue. And it's been one example like that after the next, where LeBeau has failed to offer any type of critical thinking regarding the company. Sorry, go ahead.
No, and then the proper term is that car in Shanghai had a thermal event.
Yeah.
But anyway, back to Phil. God bless him. He asked a very tough question on the call.
Phil LeBeau basically asked.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
He asked. That's what I'm saying. Like, hey, this is from a friendly, previously friendly Joe said, hey, you know, Elon, one of the things they talked about on the call was just how difficult it is to do the installation. And yeah, like, you know, no shit. Like, this is the problem with this, right? I mean, the roofing industry is, anyway, we've talked about it on the last podcast. So Phil LeBeau asks Elon something to the effect of, how many installation teams do you have right now ready to go? How many do you plan to hire? What does that ramp up in people look like? And, you know, they're talking 1,000 roofs a week. And Elon at one point says the total addressable market, you'd love it, the total addressable market for Tesla solar roof is 100 million homes. Dr. Evil, tetanus cat, 100 million homes. It's ludicrous. But Phil asked him this question. He says, how many installation teams you got, and are they ready to go? And give me some insight. And they basically punted on it. Like, they had no answer. Long pause, lots of humming and hawing, no real answer. And then Elon, as is his way, and I'd have to go back to this again, I'm pretty sure, because this is all from memory, Elon says, next question. It was not, it wasn't quite boneheaded question moment like we've had on the earnings call, but it was pretty clear, he wanted to get to the next question. This is a, I believe, half-baked product. You'll see, I guarantee you will see very nice pictures of a happy family getting a solar roof, widely published in Electric and Clean Technica in the coming weeks. Of that, I'm certain. Will this ever reach scale? I'm still very doubtful. Will the product have a meaningful impact on revenue at Tesla? I'm very doubtful. But let's see. They showed me nothing that changed my opinion as to their capacity to solve this tough problem and make money from it.
Right.
So it was a weird call. It was a weird call at the end of two terrible days for Tesla Q. And I think the primary purpose of the call was to flood Google News headlines with Solar City, Solar Roof, as opposed to Solar City, look at these depositions.
Right. Interesting. It's an interesting, the fact that to you, all these things are related. It's that's why it's interesting hearing your point of view, because you're tying things together that I haven't tied together. And
it's a consistent pattern of his, even you may have remembered Lynette Lopez put out a very damning article on something called Project Titan.
Yes.
Project Titan. If you want to explain it, go ahead, but I'm happy to explain it.
Well, Project Titan was the company's, I'm going to fuck it up and then you can explain it the right way when I'm done. Project Titan was the company's cover-up effort to cover up the fact that parts of the Solar City roofs that they were installing were catching fire. And so they had identified a part or a piece of the solar roofs that were was malfunctioning consistently, and then implemented a secret company-wide effort to try to get all of these pieces replaced on roofs that had already been installed without issuing, a major recall or making a big to-do about it, right? And something like that. Is that close?
Yeah, minor correction. It wasn't on the solar roofs. It was solar arrays on people's roofs.
Right, I'm sorry. Right.
Yeah. These are the traditional old-school Solar City arrays, and Project Titan is the name given to a stealth recall of the connectors. And I think that my personal opinion is it should have been a legitimate recall. Elon has a very high aversion to recalls, as reported in Ed Niedermeyer's book. But whether or not you like to do a recall shouldn't be an input into whether or not you should do a recall. And we're beginning to see reports of more fires on residential homes. But here's the point of me bringing that up. Project Titan, if you Google it, is the code name for Apple's electric car.
Right.
Is it just a coincidence? the guy thinks about, I believe, him and his team do a great job, all credit to them, thinking about ways to manage the headlines that people see when they Google various topics. And so when I said to you, I think the version 3 solar reveal was designed to choke out the Google searches so that when people search Solar City or Tesla Solar, they don't see these depositions. They see the fact that there's a new version 3 tile. And sure enough, if you look at the news stream right now, that's all there is.
You think that they named it Project Titan ahead of time before the, you know, before it even got out under the pretense that if it ever leaked and people searched Tesla Project Titan, all it would bring up are, you know, comparisons
Apple's
to Teslas and right. Is that what you're
Apple's
saying?
Gonna buy Tesla. I'm saying that after seeing the exact same pattern 20 times, I'm not surprised to see the pattern the 21st time.
That'd be some crafty shit. If that's
he's a crafty guy.
If that's if that's what he did, because he wasn't a guarantee that it was going to leak, right? It wasn't a guarantee that it was going to get out there. It was a while after it started before Lynette Lopez reported on it. So I mean, if he's that forward thinking, I'm inclined to give him some credit for that.
Hey, you know what? Maybe that specific story isn't true.
Right.
All I know is when you type in Project Titan Tesla, you're going to get a lot of stories about Apple should buy Tesla.
Sure, absolutely.
When you type in Solar City, Tesla Solar right now, you're not getting any stories yet on these depositions. You're getting nothing but a flood of a phone call that Elon had about a product that nobody got to see.
Right.
That, you know. So I do think the pattern is there. Let me take a step back. Do you think he obsesses over what the news cycle is?
Yes, I do.
Given that he obsesses over what the news cycle is, would it surprise you if that level of forethinking went into any particular decision?
No, it wouldn't. No.
There. So who knows if it's true? It's quite the coincidence that the Apple Car Project is named Project Titan.
Yeah, that is interesting.
Probably a coincidence. Yeah. So it is. I've seen the pattern before, and so you know one of the problems with pattern recognition is sometimes you see patterns where they're not there.
Correct.
And I'm the first to admit. That maybe this is just a total coincidence. I do think, though, that it is no coincidence that the version 3 phone call was moved to the same day as the deposition dump that Aaron over at Plainsight was able to facilitate. Of that, I'm more certain of that than I am of Project Titan. Project Titan is just a funny observation that is consistent with a long series
of moments ago you said you thought it was moved because Elon dropped it on Wednesday without informing the executive team, and so then maybe they needed a day to prepare. I mean, you're more inclined to think that
the moving from October 24th to 25th is not relevant to me. Having the call because he knows these documents are coming out is what I believe happened.
Sure.
And whether the call was on the 24th or the 25th, I think it was moved probably from the 24th to the 25th because they just weren't ready. But that, like, let's just imagine that was a seat of the pants decision for him on the call on Wednesday. What's on his mind about what's coming and how does he need to manage the headlines, I believe, is a big part of how he decides to do things.
Right. So, go ahead.
No, that's good.
I was just going to ask you, you know, kind of looking forward now from today, what is it that you're paying close attention to?
Well, you know,
assuming we covered everything about the depositions that you wanted to cover, is there anything that we left out before we start looking forward?
I just think you're going to see, you know, here we are Sunday morning. We're going to see, I think, a lot of very damning things come out of this document. I haven't read, but maybe 20% of it. We've covered what I think is the most interesting parts of it. So what's coming forward, you know, I think the most important thing on the plate is to get a hold of the 10Q and deconstruct what happened in Q3. I'd be curious to see if they raise stock this quarter. If it were me, I would raise stock.
Sure.
I would do an equity raise at these price levels. If they do that, then for sure, you know, solvency risk is forever taken off the table, and it becomes, not forever because nothing is forever, but for the effective time period that most people would be interested, solvency risk becomes effectively eliminated, and then it just becomes a valuation play, an execution play, and so on. So I think in the near term, it's the 10Q. I think in the intermediate term, you're going to see Tesla Q. You know, there's no question that some people got hurt this week and will become Houston franchise with the name and drop off. You know, just to show you how things go, you know, Charles Gasparino had this tweet this week, you know, where Tesla management is bragging to bankers that they have short sellers on the ropes. It just baffles mine that short sellers occupy such a big part of his brain. But I think there's a group of hardcore sort of Tesla Q that are in it predominantly for the analysis and for the story and for doing the fundamental research, and it's for them much less of a trade. And or people that may have lost money in the trade may not continue to trade the name, but are going to continue to participate as analysts in the sort of Tesla Q crowdsourcing experiment. And I think that's going to go on. Like, I don't think that the events of the past week are going to substantially diminish the quantity and quality of research that's going on and being shared freely on Twitter, which has been an amazing experience. And I certainly hope that it doesn't. For me personally, I'm going to continue to have, you know, small positions, short positions in the stock over time. I'm not going away. I'm going to keep doing the research. It's not clear to me what would have to happen to make me go away. Maybe, I guess, over time you just get tired of it. I'm not tired of it. It's a fascinating story. I've met many great people on Tesla Q. Been able to meet you indirectly. Lots of great people. There's something about this name that just draws a lot of eyeballs.
Well, and the interesting thing is, and I'll stop you there, but I want to hear what you have to say. Yeah. But I want to unpack that real quick. The interesting thing is, to me, you know, this isn't really much of a trade for me either anymore. I mean, certainly I feel like if things get incredibly egregious one way or another, I'll have the trade on. You know, over the last 6 months, I haven't had the trade on in any type of meaningful size, certainly not in the way that I have maybe in the 6 months or the year prior to that. You know, I also learned a lesson from Herbalife, which was one of my, you know, biggest shorts that I ever put on consistently, and company that I just loathed and can continue to loathe, and, you know, very obvious was a pyramid scheme to me. And when the Ackman Icon thing was happening, I dove into it headfirst and did the type of intense, hyper granular research that Tesla Q is doing on Tesla now. And what I learned from that experience was, you know, you can be right and you can still wind up losing money and you can still wind up getting your nuts kind of kicked in. And so, you know, I think about that now with Tesla. And, you know, to me, what keeps me engaged about this story and the reason I'm just going to continue to follow it regardless of whether or not I have a position on at the time, and I'm sure I will in the future, again, as events unfold. But to me is, you know, this is a very fascinating experiment, not only in human psychology, but in the public markets, because we're pushing a lot of boundaries. Here's the interesting thing about the story, Mr. Charts. The interesting thing is that if you are a public market veteran, if you are, you know, kind of, if you have decades of experience in the public markets, or you have a very good understanding of how disclosure is supposed to work, you have a very good understanding about what a public company's requirements to the public are, what a board of directors' requirements to its shareholders are, you know, if you have a very firm grasp on those things, you've been doing it for a while, or you're an expert, or maybe you manage money, this is a very clear, very egregious case of, you know, seemingly a lot of wrongdoing. And if you're not, if you don't have that kind of grasp on, you know, the requirements of being a public company, as I have postulated and still kind of believe that maybe even Musk himself, certainly his fucking brother, doesn't have much of a clue on, you know, for them, this is all just kind of flying by the seat of their pants. And, you know, it's like that one part in the deposition said where the lawyer asked Musk, or asked Kimball, I think it was asked Kimball Musk. I'm going to get the quote here because I want to read it to you. I have it right here on my Twitter. But, oh, there's a couple of fucking beauties here. I'm sorry to go back to the deposition. But the lawyer asks Musk, Kimball Musk, as a public company, you have disclosure obligations, right? And he answered, of course. And then the lawyer says, you disclose things that are important to shareholders that they don't necessarily ask about, right? And Musk replies, not necessarily. I don't think so. And then the lawyer responds, so everything in your public disclosures at Tesla is disclosed because a shareholder has asked about it? And Kimball responds, well, our legal counsel has asked about it. Now, to anybody that understands public disclosure, you know, of course, you have to fucking disclose things that shareholders don't ask about. That's the whole point of disclosure, is you're informing the shareholders about what's going on of a material nature at the company. And it's these types of disconnects that make this case so fucking fascinating to people that get it, like you get it, like guys like Montana Skeptic, who's a, you know, who is a 30-year attorney with a law degree from Yale, who is obviously sharp as a fucking tack. It's these kind of things that plague, you know, the people that understand how things are supposed to go. And, you know, ostensibly, you could argue the SEC is supposed to know better than anybody else that, that this is how things are supposed to go in the world of disclosure. Yet, the company has kind of made its way around the rules. And I don't know if what we're seeing is a symptom of a broader change in the markets, this kind of Fed-induced euphoria now where profits don't matter and disclosure doesn't matter and non-GAAP is fine. And I mean, we need the public markets need a plague to just reset all of this and get everybody back to square one and what the rules are. And I think this kind of shit makes this case fascinating. When I hear the chairwoman of the FTC talking about Herbalife and answer a question by saying it was not determined that they have not been a pyramid, you're like, just fucking say it, you know? And in this case, everything's right there.
Yeah.
And it just keeps drawing you in, you know, Mr. Charts. You every time a new go ahead. I'm sorry.
I got another great Kimball anecdote. We could do them all day. So remember, Kimball is facing margin calls at the time that all this is going on for his SolarCity stock. He's the chair. He's on the board of Tesla. Clearly, there's a conflict of interest there. The deposition begins with the lawyer asking Kimball if he had a conflict of interest in the SolarCity case, and he says no. But it gets better. The kitchen, which is his real passion, he's trying to raise money for the kitchen, and he's trying to raise money from people involved in both SolarCity and on the board of Tesla. And Lyndon, the CEO of SolarCity, can't participate in the raise for the kitchen in late 2015. Why? Because his SolarCity stock pledged for loans is causing a bit of a liquidity crisis for him.
Right.
And he might have to consider, wait for it, selling some SpaceX stock to meet his margin call on SolarCity. But yet, Kimball doesn't think that he's conflicted. But then my favorite part is the attorney's asking him whether or not he thinks the SolarCity transaction would be accretive to Tesla.
Right.
It's pretty clear, I think, that he either doesn't know what accretive means or he's pretending not to know what accretive means.
Well, he doesn't. They ask him, would it be accretive to Tesla? Yeah. And he's like, well, you know, I'm not a finance guy here. Let me
read it. He said, literally, you know, I'm not a finance person, so I'm more of a business leader. And my view on it was the SolarCity price was at a 52-week low or close to it, and it was an opportunity to acquire a strategic part of our future. The accretion dilution earnings per share, I think, is meant for more financially oriented folks.
Yeah, people that understand what the fuck member. Is going on. That's what he means.
There's your board member.
He's a bimbo. He's a male bimbo.
It's fascinating. it just baffles the mind. And yet, here we are, to sort of square the circle and finish where we started. Congrats to Elon. The stock is 328. He caused a thermal event in the Tesla Q community. And we'll see where it goes. You know, it's just the story rolls on. And these documents, I think, validate much of the Tesla Q hypothesis. And I can only imagine what the documents from last year and what the documents from 2019 will eventually show when the countless lawsuits wind their way through our judicial system and depositions are taken and evidence is produced. I suspect that the pattern that we saw with the SolarCity acquisition has been repeated elsewhere, and I'm looking forward to reading the documents and discovering whether that's true.
Excellent. All right, Mr. Charts. Well, listen, want to thank you very much for taking time out of your early Sunday morning to come on the podcast and explain all that shit. And let's do it again soon, man. The next time we have a major major news break, or the next time your account gets blown up again, you come on and talk about it. We'll commiserate together. And it's always great having you on, man. Really appreciate you, and I know certainly that my listeners do too. There's a lot of value in your perspective, and so I genuinely appreciate it.
And the good news is, with this stock, there'll be no shortage of fascinating things for us to talk about in the coming months.
Yeah, we'll have you back on this afternoon when the news breaks.
Yeah. All right, brother. Have a good Sunday.
Take care. That was the one, the only Mr. Tesla Charts. Follow him on Twitter, @TeslaCharts. Don't be fooled by the imposter accounts. It's @TeslaCharts. And also the gentleman who punts out all of the legal documents is Aaron Greenspan over at Plainsight. And he is @Plainsight, PlainSite. Usually, Aaron has an insatiable hunger for legal documents. And he is usually the first to break any type of legal documents related to Tesla. He's a good follow on Twitter as well. But for right now, my Wawa coffee right here. Survive that podcast, but I'm getting low. It's going to be time for a refill. Time to hit the gym. Time to get a little NFL football in. Taking the rest of the Sunday off, motherfuckers. See you this week, fools.